Hello and welcome to Mail Call, a podcast of news, letters, and stories from the Great War. We are bringing you back 100 years to the time of the First World War. This episode, we will be featuring stories about the first Russian Revolution of 1917, from January 1917 to May 1917. Our first reading today is from The Fatherland, a German weekly, from the end of January 1917, an excerpt called Rasputin, the Sorcerer of Russia.
Rasputin, the Sorcerer of Russia, by George Rafalovich. The illiterate author of My Thoughts and Reflections, Gregory Rasputin, Russia's strong sinner, is this time really dead. His carcass was thrown in the Neva's icy waters as an unclean thing. The American public, somewhat credulous when it comes to matters Russian, is told that the master of Russia's master has been murdered. They imagine at once an ordinary ruler of an ordinary land being bossed by a crazy monk. With that notion in their heads, people are trying to understand what kind of a man Rasputin was. The understanding is rendered yet more difficult by the extraordinary advertising which the most unauthoritative articles receive about Rasputin, Russia's Richelieu, if you please, otherwise the saint, alias the sacred devil, alias again, Dirty Gregory. Rasputin was known in every newspaper office of Europe and, I have no doubt, to every Department of State as well, for Rasputin seldom hid his deeds, his views, or his desires. Lest I be accused of drawing on my imagination, let me quote from C. E. Beckhoffer, a young London journalist of Russo-German descent, who states in his recent Russia at the Crossroads that Rasputin's first public appearance was as a defendant on two charges of horse theft and perjury, for the latter of which he was flogged. Later he is seen as a lay brother wandering through the villages, collecting money for the erection of a church. No church was ever erected with that money, but Rasputin built himself a comfortable house instead. Rasputin reached Petrograd one day, penniless and hungry, but with the name of a visionary and a reformed sinner. That was about 15 years ago. Gregory Rasputin made his debut before the courtiers of the Tsar, who were soon enough to tremble before him, to seek audience from him, and to beg for an introduction to the Tsar's own Secretary of State. Ask yourself, what would you do if you were told by the great ones that you were a saint? Why, you'd grow to believe it. Having come under their notice, Rasputin fostered the impression that he was endowed with mystic powers by meek denials, which were really affirmations. He played up to the Russian craving for miracles, finding that it carried with it advancement to places of confidence with those whose wishes were law. That Rasputin had hypnotic power of some sort is probably true. This power, together with his erotic vocabulary, explains the influence he had come to possess over the ladies of the Russian court. A strange animal welcomed by bored people. His outward appearance was repulsive. He was a freak. Bulgy, gray eyes glared at you. A thick beard, often dirty. Clothes that were especially at first dirty, ill-dyed, and covered with grease. These stamped him as an uncouth Muscovite peasant. His appearance was to grow more luxurious with the years of his prosperity. That was his great error. As an imitation of a gentleman, Rasputin was a ghastly failure. His hair was cut shorter, but he retained even then the anxious, unpleasant look of a lecherous degenerate. Yet emperor and empress, duchesses and countesses, prostrated themselves before Holy Gregory, kissing his feet and the sleeve of his shirt. The Tsar trusted him more than a physician when his inveterate cigarette-smoking habit brought on an affection of the throat. He is said to have admitted that he had been healed by the touch of Rasputin and by wearing at night the latter's collars. The merry man must have chuckled to himself when he explained to his visitors the manner with which the Tsar received him and when he exaggerated the anxiousness of the little father to fall in with his wishes. It may be that he carried a dark secret of the dynasty to his icy grave, but one of his secrets, at least, is ours for the taking. I refer to the secret of his power. He knew what Henry Ford, Mr. Munsey, Billy Sunday, and Theodore Roosevelt knew. He knew what his public expected of him, and he gave it to them, nice and hot. They expected miracles, kisses, impudent retorts from him. So long as he was wise enough to confine himself to that, Rasputin was safe. Russia is not so far away from centers of civilization. Petrograd is very near Copenhagen and Stockholm. It can be reached in 1, 2, and 3 days from Berlin, Vienna, and Paris. Yet Rasputin, the sacred devil, reigned over Russia after a fashion for the first 15 years of this century. There must be a reason. Do not let us transpose values. When we talk of Petrograd, Rasputin, and the Tsar, we must forget President Wilson, Billy Sunday, and Washington, D.C. Distinguished Russians found it not at all strange to bow before this peasant who had been to Jerusalem and Mount Athos and had learned nothing but evil on his journeys. We must get this into our heads. They knew him to be a villain, a homebreaker, an impostor, a rake without the outward charm of our well-dressed, well-washed men about town. And they kissed his hand, the nails of which were always filthy. Their own fears, mostly groundless and proceeding from bad consciences, made him what he was. He looked like a he-goat, behaved as one, and prime ministers of Russia were taken up or dismissed sometimes by the Tsar if Rasputin was persistent enough. Who does not absorb this contradiction will never understand Russia, and even if we reject 3/4 of what we hear, there is a bad enough state of affairs in the empire. Let us see then what Rasputin could do, and did, to prove his power over the ruler of over 100 million people and his wife.
We're going to move ahead now to March 1917, to the earliest moments of the Russian Revolution. In the March 13th edition of the New York Tribune, Revolt Threatens Russia.
Tsar suspends Duma sitting. Revolt threatens Russia. Bureaucratic cabinet, striving to crush liberals and aid Germany, faces danger of popular uprising. Entente cause suffers. London, March 12th. The issuance by Emperor Nicholas of 2 ukazes suspending the sittings of the Russian Duma and Council of the Empire is reported in a Reuters dispatch from Petrograd. The sittings will be resumed next month unless extraordinary circumstances supervene. By Isaac Don Levine. Russia today is nearer to revolution than at any other time since the outbreak of the war. The dissolution of the Duma and the Imperial Council by the Tsar, following upon the demonstrations that occurred in Petrograd and Moscow last Saturday, comes as the climax to the unparalleled tension that has prevailed in Russia since the murder of the monk Rasputin and the increase in the power of Protopopov, Minister of the Interior. It is not the food situation, critical as that is the prime cause of the present condition in Russia. It is the old political struggle between democracy and bureaucracy that is responsible for the tremendous clash which seems about to break out in the Slavic Empire. The Russian bureaucracy has done its best to precipitate this clash. For the present government of the Tsar, representing the small but powerful group of the remaining extreme reactionaries, has realized that the interests of the reactionism and bureaucracy are in complete harmony with the interests of Prussianism and the Central Powers. The Russian bureaucracy, seeing that its full participation in the war on the side of the Allies would mean its own ultimate destruction and the triumph of Russian liberalism, began to seek a rapprochement with Germany. Premier Stürmer, standing for Russian Junkerism, made several attempts to reach an understanding with the Teutons. But Russian democracy frustrated these treacherous activities. A wave of rebellion shook the nation last November and swept Stürmer out of his seat. The Duma and the Imperial Council, backed by the army and the nobility, emphatically declared their intention to fight for the cause of civilization with all the resources at their command. The dismissal of Stürmer, however, was only a partial victory. Protopopov, the hated Minister of the Interior, retained his post in the cabinet of Trepov. And Rasputin, the pernicious agent of the dark forces, continued to exert his destructive influence on the Tsar and his family. The removal of Rasputin was a vital necessity to the Allies and to Russian democracy. Members of the Duma, former cabinet ministers, and princes of royal blood combined to eliminate the omnipotent monk. Stürmer was forced out. Rasputin was slain. But Protopopov, the shrewd politician, entrenched in the citadel of reactionism, continued to defy the nation and the Allies. Unable to conclude a separate peace with Germany, Protopopov chose the longer route leading to the defeat of the Allies. He concentrated the government's energies on the demoralization of the national organism. To make Russia unfit for fighting is the aim of the present government. For that purpose, the great popular organizations working for the fullest prosecution of the war have been hampered, blocked, and interfered with. For that purpose, the efficient and beloved war minister was replaced by a new man and the brilliant chief of staff, Alexeyev, substituted by a comparative novice. For that purpose, the sessions of the Duma and the Council were postponed and suspended many times this winter, suddenly and unexpectedly. For the same purpose, the Russian government made no sincere effort to solve the food problem. The great public bodies, like the unions of zemstvos and municipalities, offered their efficient organizations to the government for the purpose of regulating the country's food supplies. The press and the people hoped that the government would accept the offer. But the government did not, for such an acceptance would eliminate the reigning chaos. And chaos is what the Tsar's present government desires. Today, a revolution in Russia is no longer a possibility, but a very strong probability. There is only one way by which such a catastrophe to the Allies can be avoided. That is the dismissal of Protopopov. A change in the government would relieve the tension, unless the Tsar is completely under the influence of the dark court clique. A cabinet crisis is to be the next development in the Russian situation.
Just a few days after this article, the Tsar stepped down from power, giving in to the revolution. For more on this historic moment, return to the pages of The Bulletin, published out of San Francisco.
Tsar abdicates, gives up throne, revolution grows, Nicholas not able to fight for his crown. London, March 15. Tsar Nicholas has abdicated his throne at the demand of the revolutionists, who are now in control of Petrograd and who are threatening to wipe out the present dynasty. Grand Duke Michael Alexandrovich, a brother, becomes regent in Russia. Chancellor of the Exchequer Andrew Bonar Law announced in the House of Commons today that Emperor Nicholas has abdicated and that Grand Duke Michael had been appointed regent. The soldiers, he said, had sided with the Duma and that the change had been effected with little loss of life. It was comforting to know, he said, that the revolution was not directed toward securing an early peace for Russia. Petrograd, March 15, by way of London, 7:43 p.m. After 3 days of battle between troops supporting it and those opposed to it, a revolution was successfully effected in Petrograd. The casualties probably did not exceed 500. It is reported that M. Protopopov, Minister of the Interior, has been killed. Emperor Nicholas had been warned that the fate of his dynasty depended on his acquiescence. The Duma joined hands with the revolution after being dissolved by the emperor and declared that the existing government had been overthrown. The Duma resumed its sitting after it had sent the notification to the emperor of these developments, warning him that the fate of the dynasty depended on his acceptance of the new order of affairs. The city is now quiet. Perfect order prevails. So far as known, no foreigners were injured. All the ministers resigned, with the exception of M. Protopopov. Former Premier Stürmer, Premier Golitsyne, and the head of the secret police were arrested. The jails were thrown open. The headquarters of the secret police and several government buildings were burned. London, March 15, 7:08 p.m. The following details of the Russian Revolution have been given to the Associated Press from a source usually well informed on Russian affairs. Quote, "The soldiers refused to act against the crowd, which started trouble when it heard the ukaz issued by Emperor Nicholas proroguing the Duma. On Sunday, the committee which had met to discuss the food situation was partly transformed into a provisional government under the presidency of President Rodzianko of the Duma, and included representatives of the Duma Council of the Empire and of the municipality. The garrison agreed to support the provisional government." End of quote. The news of the Russian Revolution, with the accompanying details, was received in the most reliable quarters in London. Information as to conditions outside of Petrograd are lacking. Russians here express disbelief that the emperor could command the support of any prominent general if he attempts to oppose the committee by force.
We turn now to a more local take on the events in Russia. We have next two articles from a Philadelphia publication, the Evening Public Ledger, from March 16, 1917.
Russian papers hail success of revolt. Organs published in U.S. say people at last get their own. New York, March 16th. Ruskoe Slovo, the Russian word, a daily newspaper published in the Russian language, says editorially this morning under the New Russia. Russia has become transformed in the course of 3 days. Our country has lived through an unprecedented historical moment, that for which Russian people have been striving for whole decades, for which they have shed seas of their precious blood, for which they have endured colossal sufferings and pains, is now an accomplished fact. The army is on the side of the revolutionist. The Russian army of today is the people themselves, all those millions of men who have been dying at the front and toiling ceaselessly in the interior of the country. Novy Mir, the New World, a daily publication in the Russian language, says editorially, since the revolt of 1905, the present supreme powers of Russia have been unable to meet the industrial, political, and economic problems of the country. Those who know Russia realize that there are three forces in the unhappy country: the reactionaries or those close to the Tsar, the combination of landlords, capitalists, and ministers who combined to form the liberals, and third, the people. The liberals wanted and still want to establish a constitutional monarchy. They want the war to continue because, having great interest themselves, they find war profitable. And they want Constantinople open because the port to the south would be of the personal commercial worth to them. But it was the people, the workers and the peasants, who fought hardest against entering the war and who wanted and still strive to establish a democratic republic. It was the people who started the present revolution. The liberals, once the revolution had been started, fell in with the revolution. The Russian people are opposed to war and to militarism, but they believe that their own success as revolutionists will mean revolution on the part of the Germanic peoples. Then they hope and believe there will become a consolidation of all the revolutionary peoples, Russian and Germanic. A combination, by its very force and weight, will compel the militarists of Europe's warring nations to cease their strife.
Opinion here divided on Russian situation. Varying opinions on the Russian Revolution are held by Philadelphia citizens conversant with the peculiar conditions existing in the great autocracy. Dr. Henry Golden of 1722 South Broad Street, one of the small group of Russian Americans in the city, said that the belief of the Russian people in the divine attributes of the Tsar would be shaken by revolution. He predicted that it would result in a constitutional form of monarchy. With a divine idea abolished, the rest will be comparatively easy. At the same time, the masses in Russia are so thick that it will take some time for them to comprehend the full significance of the situation. Rabbi Joseph Kroskop of Knesset Israel Congregation said that he was unable to form a correct opinion from the information available. He said he preferred to form his opinions on the matter when he could find whether the uprising was from distressing economic conditions or a national revolution. Dr. Golden, on the other hand, said the revolution was due to hunger. I doubt if this could be called a victory for the Allies, as the news from London seems to indicate. The Russian masses are pro-nobody. They have no quarrel with anyone. They are fighting conditions like hunger, not men or nations. this revolution in the second phase of the disturbance, which began 16 years ago. Chaos will reign, according to Dr. Golden, if the democracy gains the upper hand, or there will be, and this is more probably, a constitutional monarch with a constitutional government.
The following week, we have two items of interest from the Irish publication, The Gaelic American. We have first an article about the revolution, followed by a section of short opinions titled, Hand Grenades.
The course of the war. The event of the week past was, of course, the revolution at Petrograd, the abdication of the Tsar, and of his nominated successor, his younger brother, the Grand Duke Michael, and the assumption of power by a committee of the Duma with the aid of the garrison of Petrograd. What the immediate consequence of this act will be depends on how far it will be supported by the Russian people at large and the army in the field. Only one thing seems certain, and that is that the new governing body, having come into existence because of dissatisfaction with the government's conduct of the war, it had to pledge itself to a more vigorous prosecution of hostilities. To form anything like a correct estimate of the situation in Russia, more and accurate information is needed, and that is unobtainable. All news from there having to pass by the tainted channel of British official and other agencies, and doctored here in the Anglomaniac newspaper offices to fit in with the interest of J.P. Morgan, Kuhn, Loeb & Company, and Wall Street. All the news, therefore, coming from and about Russia should be carefully dissected and analyzed before being accepted as a basis for opinion. The German official reports from the fighting line will be about the best indication for the time being of events behind the Eastern Front. While in the countries of the Allies, the democracies are losing their liberties to plutocratic domination, the German democracy is gaining power without violence and to the advancement of national interests. In France, the fall of the Briand ministry adds to the uncertainty of the general situation in the Allied camp, while the adhesion of the Russian clergy, usually regarded as the firmest props of throne, to the Revolutionary Committee seems to assure the vote of the illiterate Moiks to the cause. The English people are now the only ones who seem impervious to the instincts of freedom and continue to follow with slave minds the gang of aristocrats, plutocrats, and moneylenders composing their government.
Hand grenades. If England is so pleased with the Russian Revolution, why did she try so hard to avert it? Strange things are happening these times. They restored order in Russia by putting the government and police in prison. Well, Nicholas can't feel very sore about the upset if his brother Mike is allowed to fill his place. A London cable dispatch says the ambassadors of the Allies have established relations with the Russian Duma. Maybe they have, and then again maybe they haven't. If they have, it's a case of off with the old, on with the new. England never remained loyal to anybody longer than her selfish interests dictated. A blow against those in authority who aimed at a separate peace is how the Allies' press agents described the revolution in Russia. Time will tell ski whether it is or not ski. When Tsar Nicholas found that his crown was likely to attract a lightning bolt, he hardly hid it in the mattress or a coal scuttle. We wonder if the Russian revolutionist will give the imprisoned members of the Tsar's cabinet any cabinet pudding while they are soliloquizing in jail over the ups and downs of life. Tsar Nicholas suspended the Duma, but the darn Duma wasn't obliging enough to say suspended.
We now jump ahead 1 month to April 29th, 1917. We'll hear now a little bit about the arts in Russia. From the pages of The Sun, Russian drama will find fresh inspiration in new freedom.
Russian drama will find fresh inspiration in its new freedom. Richard Ordynsky and Ossip Dimal look for plays of another kind now that the restrictions of the censorship have been removed. In an upper room at the Bandbox Theater, two men sat and talked the other day about the Russian Revolution and the effect it will have on Russian drama. They were Richard Ordynsky and Ossip Dimal. Probably no other men in America are better qualified to discuss the theater in Russia. Both of them have been actively connected with it. Mr. Ordynsky is a producing manager, Mr. Dimal a playwright. One of his plays, New, was recently given at the Bandbox under the Urban Ordynsky management. Both men are still young. Both are radicals in art as well as in politics. Both have known what it was to work under the most oppressive and most stupid censorship in the world. Both kindle with enthusiasm as they talk of a free theater in free Russia. "There is always one thing," said Ordynsky, "that you Americans complain of in our Russian drama. You say it is gloomy, repressed, it lacks action." Gloomy? What else could it be? Repressed? Wasn't that the whole spirit of the Russian people? Let me tell you, imagine a great cafe in a Russian city, Moscow, for example. Suppose you had gone into that cafe some night before the revolution. You would have found every table taken. There would have been perhaps 400 persons there, and yet you would have heard hardly a sound of a human voice. If you had shut your eyes, you would have thought it a company of deaf mutes. He leaned forward, as if across a table, and spoke in barely audible tones. Everyone talked under his breath like this. It was always so. Russia has had to guard every word. Can a people be gay under those conditions? And the drama, you know, was less free than individual speech, less free than even literature. Not a line could be printed without being stamped with official permission to publish. But when a play had passed the censor at Petrograd, its troubles were not over. It had to run the gauntlet of hundreds of minor censorships. Each town where it was produced had some little official who decided whether it might be played in the local theater or not. Most of them were stupid. All of them had their personal prejudices, and it made no difference how great the author. Every line he had written was at the mercy of some provincial nobody who liked to feel his importance. The consequence was that a play could be given in one town and suppressed in another, that lines which would be permitted in Moscow had to be changed in Kiev. It was absurd, but in its effect on the spirit of the author, it was also tragic. "Oh, the whole thing was impossible," broke in Dimal. "You cannot conceive the stupidities of the censorship. Imagine that there could not be a play in which there was a trial scene. A jury must not be shown on a Russian stage, nor a priest, nor a funeral, nor an icon, nor an officer, unless he was a nice officer who talked about loyalty to the government. If a play called for a priest, we had to substitute an old man with a long beard. Everybody knew he was meant for a priest." That was the absurdity of it. A whole system of hidden understandings grew up. For instance, one could not mention socialism on the stage, but if a character said, "I demand justice," it was understood that he meant he wanted socialism. "And now," I asked, "will there be a new drama in Russia?" "Unquestionably," exclaimed Ordynsky, "and it will be as different from the old drama as a man in chains is different from a man that is free. Dimal here is already planning to go back to Russia, because at last he can do the work he has wanted to do. You will see, I believe, a great dramatic awakening in Russia." "Did the Tsar go to the theater?" I asked. "No," said Dimal scornfully. "In 10 years he never went even to the Imperial Theater in Petrograd. He was afraid. Night after night for years the Imperial box was empty, except for two soldiers, one at either side, standing rigidly, guarding vacancy. He had a small theater in the palace at Tsar Kaselo, and occasionally he had a company play there. But he has the intelligence of a child. The only plays he cares for are one-act farces, stupid, crude things of the kind that appeal to the commonest, uneducated people. I've been told by those who saw him that he would laugh immoderately over these farces, and yet he had absolute authority over every author in Russia. Do you wonder that men writing under the shadow of such conditions produced gloomy plays? Will most of the Russian dramatists welcome the revolution?" "Most of them," exclaimed Dimal in surprise. "All of them. All writers in Russia are radicals. If there are a few exceptions, men who have written in support of the bureaucracy, they have been made to feel that they were outside the fellowship of intellectuals. If a man did write anything tainted with reactionary spirit, well, we didn't see him after that. No, the men who have made Russian drama what it is, made it in spite of indescribable difficulties and discouragements, are heart and soul in sympathy with the new government. I am going back myself to work for Russia. I believe we shall send you dramas that will reveal a whole new life of a people that has never before been able to express itself freely."
At the same time, reliable accounts of the revolution start to reach American journalists. Thus, we start to see the true picture of the events in Petrograd the month before. One such article is this one, from the pages of the New York Tribune, published April 29, 1917.
Masses forced the Duma to help set Russia free. The first true and sequential account of the revolution, reproduced from its official bulletins, by Sigdan Levine. The full story of the Russian Revolution has just arrived in this country. The news bulletins issued daily during the revolution by the executive committees of the Duma and the Council of Workmen's and Soldiers' Deputies have come to the Tribune. It is possible now to give a sequential account of the dramatic events that occurred in the Petrograd in the middle of March. Contrary to the impression created by the news dispatchers, it appears that the overthrow of Tsarism was not the work of the Duma, but of the labor classes. When Paul Milukov, the Duma leader and now foreign minister, first became aware of what was going on in the streets of Petrograd, he exclaimed, "It will be over in a quarter of an hour," expecting soldiers and police to crush the revolution. The Duma, therefore, was not prepared for a successful revolution. It was only when the masses had won over the soldier and defeated the police that the Duma joined in the upheaval. Organized labor movements produce the great results that astonish the world. On March the 6th, the strike began. On the 7th, all the textile workers were out. On the 8th, the last newspapers appeared. The whole populace of the city turned out into the streets with cries of "Give us bread!" For 2 days, the Cossacks and soldiers sent out to disperse the crowds are fraternized with them, accompanied by universal ovations. Demonstrations began on Sunday, March 11th. Hundreds of thousands marched toward the Winter Palace. This date marks the beginning of the revolution. On Sunday afternoon, the police charged the crowds, but the soldiers ordered to do so refused point blank. The police were savage, causing considerable casualties. The storm, however, burst on Monday, March 12th. Enormous crowds rushed to the arsenals and arms factories to arm themselves. The cordons of police were everywhere smashed, and with the help of the soldiers, the working men turned upon the police. The first bulletin was issued on the afternoon of March 12th. Across the whole page is a three-line head reading: "The newspapers are not appearing. Events are developing too rapidly. The population ought to know what is going on." The bulletin contains the Tsar's edict dissolving the Duma and the Duma's resolution not to close its session. 25,000 soldiers joined the revolutionists on that day. At 2 o'clock, the revolutionary soldiers, followed by the armed populace, arrived at the Duma. The socialist deputies Tsikhedze, Kerensky, Skobelev came out to address the revolutionary army. The chiefs of the revolution then detailed rebel soldiers to guard the Duma. At 2:30 o'clock, the Duma met. The question of organizing a temporary committee to restore order in Petrograd was discussed. In view of the crowded assembly, it was decided to let the Council of Elders of the Duma appoint this committee. It became known under the name of the Temporary Executive Committee of the Duma. The day was eventful in the progress of the rebellion. The president of the Imperial Council, Zhegloviev, was arrested and imprisoned at 5:30 o'clock in the building of the Duma. The famous prison Kresty, where political offenders were held in large numbers, was taken by the Revolutionary Army the same afternoon. The smaller prisons were captured almost without opposition. The Secret Service Department was set on fire. All the archives were destroyed. So numerous and bulky were the espionage documents that for 3 days they continued to burn. The following morning at 2 o'clock, the Executive Committee of the Duma issued two proclamations, calling upon the population to refrain from violent and destructive acts as well as to recognize the gravity of the situation and help it to restore order and law. The same morning, the Council of Workmen's and Soldiers' Deputies appealed to the masses to stand by it in its effort to demolish completely the old regime and create a new government through the Constituent Assembly elected on the basis of universal, secret and direct suffrage. The Executive Committee of the Duma placed Deputy Engelgard in command of Petrograd. During this day, ex-Premier Sturmer, General Kurlov, General Komissarov and many other high officials were arrested. The Duma Committee dispatched special commissioners to take charge of the railroad, telegraph and telephone lines and various other public utilities. The disorder in the streets continued all day, largely being encounters between the police and the revolutionists. On March 14th, the Duma Committee wired to all the cities of the empire that it was in the charge of the nation. On the previous night, Alexander Protopopov, the Minister of the Interior, who was a real dictator of Russia up to the revolution, surrendered himself to the Duma. At 9 in the morning, the Emperor's personal guard joined the Revolutionary Army. The Winter Palace, the Tsar's Petrograd residence, was occupied there by the rebels. The official telegraph agency was taken over by Deputy Gronsky. A city militia was formed to keep order. Ex-Premier Garamikin was arrested with the rest of the ministers. The day closed with the following proclamation. Citizens, the great thing has happened. The old government that oppressed Russia had dissolved itself. The Committee of the Duma and the Council of Labor Deputies are restoring order and law in the country. The first task at the present moment is supplying of the army and the people with food. Citizens, help your country with bread and work. The 15th of March, the fourth day of the revolution, still found Russia without permanent government. The Tsar was still ruling nominally. No new cabinet had been formed, and yet the population was behaving itself wonderfully. The daily bulletins kept all Petrograd informed of the latest developments. They were distributed free. The temporary committee then proceeded to restore order. Professor Yurevich was appointed chief of police, the first professor in Russia to hold such a post. A special committee was immediately formed to elaborate a plan for a general political amnesty. The labor group issued an appeal calling for obedience to all the regulations and orders of the temporary committee. The negotiations were closed at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The provisional government, which now is in control of Russia, was a result of the joint council. Milyukov outlines the nature of the new cabinet's program. As he read the names of the ministers, those who belonged to the radical wing received the greater applause. Kerensky, who was given the portfolio of Minister of Justice, was cheered most of all. When the speaker announced the decision of the two committees to depose that old despot, the Tsar, there was general applause. But when he declared that, temporarily at least, the dynasty will be retained, there was a chorus of disapproval. Finally, it was decided to demand the abdication of Nicholas II, to proclaim temporarily as regent Grand Duke Michael, and to leave the Tsar's son as high parent. The revolutionary masses greeted the latter decision with outspoken hostility. While the emissaries of the Duma went to Pskov, where the Tsar was, to obtain his signature to the abdication decree, the revolutionary elements increased their pressure on the Council of Deputies in favor of the abolition of the monarchy. It was this pressure that made Russia a republic. The Duma favored a constitutional monarchy, but after the emperor abdicated, it yielded to the insistent demands of the workmen and soldiers and caused the Grand Duke Michael to abdicate his rights also. The masses began the revolution, and the masses freed Russia of the Romanovs and made her a republic. The liberal Duma was too timid to make full use of the opportunities of the moment, and it was a courageous council of workmen and soldiers' deputies that transformed Russia from the most absolutist autocracy in the world into the most radically government-grade nation.
In this same vein of revelation, we bring you this next piece from the Evening Star, published out of Washington, D.C. This article from May 1917 relays the first-hand account of Jasper Mayer, an American who took part in the Russian Revolution.
America tells of Russia's bloodless revolution. It is Monday, February 27th, March 12th by our calendar. The Duma has proclaimed a new government. Not yet is there a shred of organized authority to control the situation. There is no government. The perfect freedom, dire dream of illiterate anarchists, actually prevails. Here, indeed, is a chance for chaos. But the chaos does not come. There is occasional fighting between soldiers, now in the ranks of the revolutionists, and the police, loyal to the last to the old regime. The streets are filled with people, thousands and thousands of them. But they are, for the most part, orderly. Occasionally, a machine gun crackles and sputters from some concealed roof, as often as not missing the street altogether and bombarding the second story of a house across the street. Jewelry shops display thousands of dollars worth of gems in their windows. No one rifles them. food shops containing the food the people revolted to obtain are left intact. Stores of sugar are not touched, though the government's sugar cards, by which each family was allotted its 3 pounds a week, were destroyed along with other government records. This indeed is a new sort of revolution, the like of which the world has never known. The birth of the Russian democracy will go down in history, this young American narrator thinks, not only for its tremendous effects, but for its unique functioning. The young man who tells the story is Jasper J. Meyer, the only American injured in Russia's revolution, and the first American but one to return to this country after seeing the historic overthrow of the Tsar. He is a clean-cut young American, graduate of the University of Kansas in 1913, who had been in Russia to study the language and social conditions. For 6 months, he had been feeling the pulse of the Russian people, studying their ways of thinking and of doing things. He brings this message. The revolution was bloodless comparatively because Russia was prepared for it, Mr. Meyer believes. Expressions that a new government must come, which could have been treasonable and fatal before the war, were made openly by high city officials. These officials, however, advised that no steps be taken for the change until after the war, when they believed they could be accomplished by peaceful political means. But the revolution was precipitated by that time-worn cause of revolution, the cry in Petrograd, "We want bread." "Of what use are my 15 rubles a day if I cannot buy food with them?" one working man in Petrograd said to Mr. Meyer just before the outbreak. Men stood in line from 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning until the factory whistles blew, then went to work famished, with the gnawing mental pain of hungry wives and children. In all, only about 4,000 persons were killed in Petrograd out of the 2 million in the city at the time. History shows, however, that the overthrow of the existing government usually does not put an end to carnage and disorder. Revolution is apt to continue with added horrors until some form of authority is evolved from the chaos that follows. To understand why this was not the case in Russia, one must know the Russian people, Mr. Meyer said. They are docile, good-natured, without much ambition, and bound to the observance of law even when its enforcement is removed by centuries of severe discipline. Thus Petrograd went about its business, much as if nothing had happened, and the principal evidence of the revolution, aside from the occasional skirmishes, was the continuous crowd on the streets. Along with other papers, the sugar cards were thrown into the flames, but just the same, the people lined up in front of the stations the next day, waiting for their cards to get sugar, though they had helped burn the cards themselves. Though they destroyed the cards, they drew the line at helping themselves to sugar. There were many cases like this showing the childlike simplicity of the Russian people. The first proclamation of the new government, constituted of the existing Duma, was followed by others which called upon various sections of the city, and especially the apartment houses and Red Cross units, to form temporary local government units. This was done, and it accounted partly for the excellent order of the early days of the Duma's rule. Apartments had watchmen recruited from their own tenants, sections engaged policemen, and leaders in these communities took a part in prevention of what little lawlessness threatened. The better class of working men showed every willingness to go back to work, but it was soon realized that they would have to be represented in government. The anarchists went about proclaiming that the old government had failed and urging that no government at all be organized to replace it. The socialists demanded a much more radical reconstruction than the Duma favored. So the soldiers and working men, two terms that were largely synonymous so far as class distinction goes, and the socialist element were invited to appoint representatives to cooperate with the Duma. The working men and soldiers responded, and the present deputy committee of these groups was the result. The socialists refused. But one of the socialist leaders, the Minister of Justice now, Kerensky, is a powerful factor in the existing government, said Mr. Meyer. He is cool-headed, of the upper socialist group, and not of the anarchistic type. And he has tremendous influence, said Mr. Meyer. I talked with him just before I left, and he expressed confident belief that the war would be prosecuted. I was surprised when I reached home to find that he now seems less optimistic. It is not generally realized here that the Committee of Soldiers and Workingmen does not represent these classes in Russia, but principally the anarchistic and more radical element in Petrograd only. Moscow sent a delegation to protest against some features of their activities, and demanded that working men return to their places of employment. Within 3 weeks after the first proclamation of the new government, 2/3 of them had done so.
Wrapping up this week of Mail Call, we bring you to London for piece on the new political landscape of East Europe following the Russian Revolution. From TP's Journal for Men and Women, Buffer States of Peace.
Buffer States of Peace. Much has been written and will yet be written about the terms of the next peace, but one gets a feeling frequently that publicists and politicians are too near to the mountain and miss a clear view of the summit in consequence of some lesser elevations of personal interest that obscure the view. The extent of the various national interests involved at the beginning of the war burst upon the world in the nature of a volcanic eruption. But many nations that were only remotely concerned with the cause of the war have their whole future outlooks involved in the conditions of peace. Moreover, solutions that were possible 2 years ago have since lost their value, and a new standard of adjustment has to be set up. Perhaps the most interesting change has been brought about by the Great Revolution in Russia. Previous to the revolution, peace terms might have been arranged which would have given autonomy to Russian Poland only. Galicia and German Poland might have remained in the hands of Austria and Germany respectively. Under such a settlement, there would undoubtedly have been a good deal of legitimate misgivings as to whether peace could be long maintained between Germany and Russia. The revolution has changed the relationship, though in an entirely opposite direction to what is popularly surmised. Under the old regime, war between Russia and Germany was much more unlikely than was generally supposed, and Russia's intervention in the struggle, on behalf of her ally France, upset a great many of the calculations of the German intriguers, both in Russia and in Germany. And now one of the very best guarantees, if a vicious and conspiring element can ever be a guarantee, has been removed from Russia by the revolution. Peace, even an armed peace, with all the underlying elements of suspicion and distrust, was a more possible thing before the revolution than it is now, and this in spite of all the efforts that are supposed to have been made recently to reconcile the democracies of Russia and Germany. If the new order of things in Russia is true to its conception, there can be no peace founded on anything other than the complete security against Prussian aggression. Thus, the question of Polish autonomy takes on new and greater importance. A buffer state of Russian Poland merely would not solve the problem, even if the Polish people were satisfied. There would still be a long land frontier line from Poland to the Baltic, and another long line from Poland to the Romanian border. But the Polish people would not be satisfied. Any autonomy which denies to them Austrian Poland and German Poland would only be a source of further trouble in days to come. A Poland without Posen in the Polish portion of East Prussia, a Poland without Krakow in the vast population of Poles and Galicia, even a Poland without a port on the Baltic would be like a man without his limbs, an entity certainly, but denied that freedom of movement and full usefulness which by right belongs to every nation in its own sphere. A complete Poland with an outlet on the Baltic would serve two purposes at once. National aspirations would be satisfied on the one hand, and on the other, the German and Russian empires would be separated by a state owning allegiance to neither, and protected from both by such a scrap of paper as no nation will ever again seek to trample underfoot.
That's all for Mail Call, a podcast of newsletters and stories from the Great War. Historical documents for this episode were accessed through the digital collections and digital library at Villanova University and the Library of Congress. The theme music is from Till We Meet Again, as performed by Nicholas Orlando's Orchestra. The Mail Call podcast is a project of Home Before the Leaves Fall, a Great War centennial exposition. For more information, visit our website at wwionline.org. This episode featured the voice talents of Anne Minakazi, Adele Lindenmeyer, Father Joseph Loya, Tanya Kravchuk-Kupon, Chris Washburn, Soren Shah, Chika Shah, Kim Scheimer, Amanda McCollum, and Christine Booker. I'm your host, Chris Hallberg. This episode was produced and edited by Amanda McCollum. Executive producers are Laura Bang and Amanda McCauley. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Mail Call. And for more, please visit our website at wwionline.org. Amen.